questions.
Great. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. This is based on some work I did with this cast of characters. An alternative title could be, this will annoy some people in the room. Oh, now you have to go through my awesome graphics again. Jeez. Yeah, okay. I don't know how to use a computer. All right, dark matter when astrophysics doesn't matter. You'll see what I mean by that as we go on. It's, of course, deliberately flippant. Okay, so here's an approximate plan for what I'll talk about. I'll remind you, although this audience needs no reminding, about direct detection and all the standard assumptions that go into it. We've had several nice review talks on this earlier in the week as well. I'll just add my little 2 cents worth to that. Then I'll talk about how to compare multiple experiments, how to extract this quantity that we've heard a little bit about, this g of v, the integral of f of v. I'll talk a little bit about the CDMS recent results, some few simple thoughts about them, and then we'll hopefully conclude. Okay, so here's a formula you all know and love, and there was a great overview talk earlier in the week as well by Anne. So this is how you calculate the rate you'd expect to see at a direct detection experiment. It's simple, straightforward enough for Endeavor. I've color-coded a few of the inputs. I think Anne did a similar thing as well, where the stuff in blue is information from astrophysics, and the stuff in red is determined by particle physics. So you know this formula. And of course, what usually happens is you imagine that the scattering cross-section takes a form like this. There's some nuclear form factor. This thing is dead. There's a nuclear form factor that you can look up in some big book somewhere. And then there's the scattering cross-section, which typically takes on one of these few simple forms. You can either imagine it's once you've extracted this nuclear form factor, it's relatively constant, or there may be a form factor due to the dark matter having some composite structure or something, or you may imagine even that the scattering cross-section is velocity dependent, but still factorizes in this nice form, or you could imagine the most general thing where it's some horrible function of both the incoming velocity of the dark matter and the exchanged energy. But typically, we imagine one of these first two or three simple forms. And for the most simple, usual case that you're used to seeing, the spin-independent elastic wimp, the scattering cross-section off a nucleus is what appears up here, is related to the scattering cross-section off a proton or a neutron in this way. And the V-min that determines what section of the speed distribution you're integrating over is calculated in this way. So you all know these things, but it's worth putting them all in one transparency just so you can remind yourselves. So what do we know about some of the astrophysical inputs? So what do we know about the stuff in blue? Well, we think we have some idea as to what the local abundance of dark matter is. It's roughly a third of a GeV per centimeter cubed, we believe, give or take a bit. And then we think we have some idea as to what this speed distribution looks like. And so what's usually assumed is that it takes this nice simple form, a Maxwell-Boltzmann, with a characteristic speed of about 200 kilometers a second and some escape velocity that's a little bit larger. Where's it gone? There it is. Something in this ballpark, 600 kilometers a second. I guess the units have dropped off the right-hand side here. But as we heard earlier in the week, it's not. We don't really believe that the velocity or the speed distribution follows a perfect Maxwell-Boltzmann. You know, there's lots of complicated physics going on, and people have tried to simulate this, and we know that there are deviations in the n-body simulations from a perfect Maxwell-Boltzmann. And we heard from Marangela as well about recently acquired stuff that doesn't have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution at all. This debris flow that can have a different speed distribution. And also, as Anne pointed out, the direct detection experiments have been running only for a few decades, which means they haven't probed very much. They haven't transited through the dark matter distribution for very long, and so the scales that they're resolving in the direct detection experiments are far below what we're capable of resolving in the n-body simulations at present. So even though we can take this input and put it back into the previous formula, we can't be completely sure that that's exactly what we're seeing. That's where we are on the Earth, where we are in the galaxy. So can we do better? Well, so of course, it's a worthwhile enterprise to use these inputs into that formula and see what you would expect to see for different dark matter candidates. But suppose we actually have a measurement in a direct detection experiment. Can we use that to our advantage to learn more about the this distribution? Of course we can. And we're not the first people to say this. There are a whole host of papers started out a little while ago by Dries and company that says if you measure a rate in a direct detection experiment, there's some you can massage the rate that you see, that the distribution of events that you see, and extract from that by doing a few games, you can extract from it the speed distribution, assuming that you've measured this rate well enough, of course. You have enough events, but you can't. This is basically the only way we have of determining the local speed distribution at present. But it can be done, and this is what you would do. So if you have the observed rate, oh, I should have said one more thing, sorry. Where is it? So this script R is something I'll call the deconvoluted rate, which is basically the rate you observe in the detector dividing out by the known nuclear form factor. So once you've removed this, that's what appears in this script R. You take a derivative of this script R with respect to the recoil energy, and in this way, and then you can extract for a given dark matter mass, where is it, for a given embedded here in the reduced mass. But for a given dark matter mass, this then will tell you what the speed distribution looks like, just by taking a derivative of the observed the scattering rate. And so this is what you'd expect. And then there's a nice observation you can make, that we know that this speed distribution, being a distribution, is always positive definite. So it tells you the probability of seeing a particle with a certain speed. So of course, this object has to be greater than zero. And you notice this right-hand side starts out with a minus sign. And so if you look at this expression, the only way to make these two things consistent, if you, for a second, don't imagine any fancy particle physics, so there's no inelastic splitting or anything, it's delta zero. And if, for a second, you allow me to turn off the, or set the dark matter form factor to one, just to make things simple, so this term disappears, then in that simple elastic spin-independent case, the fact that this has to be positive tells you that the rate has to be dropping, which is no news, we all knew that. That the rate the deconvoluted rate you observe at these experiments should be a monotonically decreasing function. So the flip side of this is, of course, if you were to see a rate that doesn't decrease monotonically, then it tells you that there has to be some new interesting physics going on, in addition to observing dark matter. There has to be either a form factor for the dark matter, or there has to be some sort of splitting in the scattering. It can't be elastic. So that's one very simple observation. So this deconvoluted rate is a fun thing to think about. So let's just look at a few toy examples that will be useful later on in the talk. If you imagine that the speed distribution looked like this, so basically a delta function, if you imagine that all the dark matter was moving at exactly the same speed, so this is if the halo was completely dominated by a stream, for instance, then you'd expect the deconvoluted rate to look like this blue line here, basically for energies below a certain, I imagined I was looking at xenon results here, but it doesn't really matter. So below a certain recoil energy, your V min would be below where the stream is, and you would be sensitive to the stream, and so you would have rate, and above that recoil energy, you wouldn't have anything. So you'd expect a step function. What's plotted here in red is once I put back in the form factor. So you see, unfortunately, once you include the fact that you have a nuclear form factor, many of these distributions start to look relatively similar. So you have to have a pretty good measurement in the direct detection experiment. But assuming you had such a measurement and you could undo the form factor and then distinguish these various blue possibilities for the deconvoluted rate, you'd be able to back out what the speed distribution is by using the formula on the previous slide. So here's another example. If it was some rather broad distribution, but basically the speeds were confined to a window, then you'd expect to see a deconvoluted rate like that, and so on and so forth. Okay, so that's what you would do if you have a very high precision measurement and you want to extract the speed distribution. Then, of course, you can take this and compare to predictions we have from simulations. But that's probably a long way off, because you need a fair amount of statistics to do that. But there's some other things you can do with this approach. So here is the master formula again. And what you notice for direct detection experiments, this quantity, this f of v, is very interesting in its own right. But as far as direct detection is concerned, what really influences it is the integral of this speed distribution divided by the velocity. And if we call that integral g of v, in fact, it's really a function of the lower limit of the integral, the minimum velocity to scatter. Because the maximum velocity is, of course, the escape velocity, it is what it is. But this v min varies with the recoil energy in this way. So as I was saying, the direct detection experiments really depend upon this integral quantity, not the actual distribution itself. And so you can rewrite the recoil energy, the recoil spectrum like this. And you notice it falls neatly into two pieces. One piece here is circled in blue, which depends upon which direct detection experiment you're talking about. It depends upon what's your target, whether you have xenon or germanium or silicon or whatever. And it's specific to each experiment. And then you have a piece here which is independent of the experiment. It's the same for all experiments because they're all sampling the same abundance in the halo, and they're all sampling this this integral in the same way. Well, it's the same integral that's entering in each case. So that the point is, if you have a measurement or a limit from one experiment, so you have a limit or an observation of this quantity from one experiment, you can then extract this target-independent quantity, and you can walk over to your rival's experiment and use that as an input to their input to their experiment and see if the two rates agree. So you can see if this target-independent piece is the same, is consistent between two experiments, or inconsistent. Sorry? V min depends on the target, but that's correct. So that's a very good point. So you have to be sure that the two experiments are probing the same range of V min. But the point is that this G of V is you know, it's quote unquote God given. I mean, it's just, it is what it is, right? And then the question is whether the range of V min's being probed at the two experiments are the same. I'll get to that in more detail in just a second. But that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point. I think I actually have a plot on that in a couple of transparencies, so let me get back to that. So just to somewhat belabor this trivial point, that the speed distribution is positive tells you that this g of v min, which is the integral of the speed distribution from v min to v escape or infinity, that this integral is a monotonically decreasing function. It's useful to remind yourself about what is the least monotonic function you can think of. So the most conservative assumption you can make, if you have if you think you've measured a g of v at one experiment, or you think you've measured it at one velocity, the most conservative thing you can imagine is that for all speeds below the v min you think you've probed, this g of v is the same. So in other words, this is the least a downward step function, something that's constant for a while and then stops and goes to zero, is, if you like, the most conservative assumption you can make. It's the least monotonic function. So that'll be, and it of course corresponds to a speed distribution that's a delta function at this point here. So if you have an experiment and you think you have some events, and the energy of the highest event will determine for you the largest V min, and then from that V min down, you can imagine that this G of V is just a constant. So that's you see that in one experiment, and then you can take this G of V to another experiment and see what it predicts. So the idea is that you of course the downfall of this is that the dark matter mass appears in various places, and so going from one experiment to another how you go from one experiment to another will depend upon the dark matter mass, which is an unknown at present. So you would have to do this translation between two experiments for multiple dark matter masses and see if there was one or many masses that would allow the two results to be consistent. But you can't just do it for one mass, unless of course you have another experiment like the LHC or something that has nailed down the dark matter mass. But at present, you have to follow this algorithm. So you have to make a guess about the dark matter mass, And then you use one experiment to extract G of V, or G of V times rho, because they always come together. And then you use this extracted quantity from one experiment as an input to a second experiment, and then you compare that prediction to what the second experiment actually sees. And of course, if it's consistent, then your hypothesis was a good one, and that's a viable dark matter mass. And if it wasn't, then you have to start again making another hypothesis and see if you can find a set of masses that is consistent. So you have to make sure the experiments ran over the same time of the year, because I've suppressed some time dependence in that speed distribution for the sake of clarity. But of course, if there is the point that the Earth is moving, so at least at the tens of kilometers per second level, there is a slight difference if they're running at different times. But that's not something that's you can get around that. Yuri Zupan and collaborators have thought about that. So following that algorithm, what you would do is simply extract the G of V min from one experiment by just inverting that expression previously. So you take the observed rate, divide out by all the target-dependent pieces, and you're left with the astro-dependent piece, the target-independent piece. You take that, and you make a prediction for the second rate. So if you were to follow that procedure, you end up like this. So you have to, now, of course, what you really can compare, as Louis said, is you have to compare V-mins to V-mins. So you have to compare the same V-min in one experiment to the same V-min in the second experiment. But because the minimum speed that the dark matter can come in with to create a certain energy recoil depends upon not only the dark matter mass, but upon the target mass as well. So there's a translation, since you now have to go through this V-min space, and V-min is the one thing that remains the same, there's a translation between the energy in one experiment and the energy in the second experiment. So, and there's a typo. That should be E1. That should be E2, sorry. That's fine. That is the translation between the two energies, which gets around your complaint. So the point is, so now you can forget about V-min space and simply look at this mapping from energy 1 to energy 2, since you know the one thing that remains fixed is the V-min, right? And then you simply have to ask the question, is the energy that the one experiment sees, is that in the range of... is that within the window of things that the second experiment can observe? If it's below their threshold, then, you're in trouble. So the point is, this V-min space is sort of the screen that the two experiments project on. So here you have, what have we got here? We've got silicon and xenon. So if you for a 8 GeV WIMP, just picking a random number, if you tell me what the recoil energy was of an event at silicon, I can then map that to a V-min, and it tells me for all, now I'd make this the least, or the most conservative assumption I can, is that this G of V is now constant from that value, from that V-min all the way down to zero. So from here all the way down, it's the same value. And that basically means for all energies that probe that V-min or lower in xenon, they should expect to see an event. Now, of course, you have to take into account the efficiencies and the exposures and all that stuff. So let's pick a, like I said, 10 GeV, that comes across as 500 kilometers a second. So for 3 keV and below, you'd expect xenon to see something. Does that answer your question about xenon? Okay. So that's the game. And so you can already see that for an 8 GeV WIMP, we know that there are three events at CDMS, and they're sort of in the 8 to 12 keV window. So there's some hope, depending on exactly what mass you pick, that xenon will have some sensitivity to it. So you can make that a bit easier without, you can remove this whole V-min story and just look at the translation of energies to energies. So these are the energies of the three events that CDMS sees scattering off silicon. Here is a function of the dark matter mass, is the energy each of them translates into at xenon. And then without using any astrophysics input, you know the most conservative thing you could imagine then is that you'd expect to see rate from that energy downwards. So so this is something you can do comparing any two experiments. So we did this a while ago when Cogent first came out. And basically the idea is to just, if you have, so Cogent's nice in the sense that it has lots of events. Most of them probably aren't dark matter, but at least it allows you to make a nice plot. So you can take the observed rate, mod out by this, or divide out by this, the form factor, as I said, and then this is basically a surrogate for this g of v, and then you carry out this energy translation between the two experiments, and you can basically see this is what Kogent sees, you read these axes, and this is what Zenon would expect to see if you read these axes. And but of course, you still have to include exposures, efficiencies, and so on to get the actual rate. This is in Drew. So by doing this, this allows for a completely astrophysics independent comparison of experiments. So you can repeat this enterprise with not only actual events, but also with bounds. You can say, well, I don't expect to see more if I have no events in my detector. That puts an upper bound of sort of 2.3 events or something, whatever is the 90% Poisson level limit on zero. And so that allows me to put a bound on the size of this G of V, and then I could take that bound and go over to another experiment and put a constraint on how many events that second experiment would plan to see. And so the useful thing to compare between experiments is this astrophysics, this target-independent, astrophysics-dependent quantity. So you can basically decide that this is a measurement of this quantity or a bound of this quantity, depending on what type of experimental result you have. And so this is from a while ago. This is the plot of this G of V min as a function of V min, and this would be the old data from Cogent from a while back, and the various bounds that existed at the time that we made the plot, and you could see, independent of astrophysics, whether there was tension or not. So that's an old plot, but of course there have been new results since that plot was made, and people have basically reproduced that plot, but with the new data. So this is from the group in Oxford. So as I said, the one unfortunate thing, or maybe not unfortunate, but the one added complexity is that you have to make this plot of various choices of dark matter mass, because it, exactly what this translation is depends upon the mass of the dark matter. And so you have to scan over dark matter mass and see if there's any dark matter mass that allows the results from the various experiments to be consistent with one another. And here they also were good enough to change their binning and see if it changed the result, and it didn't. So that was a nice consistency check. But here you have the bounds from xenon 100 is this steep purple line, and then the results from silicon are the data points. And so what xenon is saying is that this G quantity has to be smaller than this curve, and clearly there's quite a lot of tension, especially for the high event, which is what you would have expected given what we saw in the previous transparency. That this highest event is well into the wheelhouse of xenon for most dark matter masses. These lower events, you start to get into the area where the efficiency is turning on, and you worry a little bit about exactly what L effective is, and so on and so forth. So that was carried out by the Oxford group. There was another, almost at the same time, group from UCLA and Utah that did roughly the same thing. And again, they find a little bit of tension between CDMS and xenon. So of course, we knew this tension was there, even independent of astrophysics, because you could carry out the same calculation and make the usual sigma m plot and see that the results weren't consistent with one another. But this is a nice way of doing it, just because often in that sigma m plot, you'll be integrating over the high velocity part or the high speed part, the high speed tail of this distribution that we haven't actually probed in any of the experiments, so we're not entirely sure it's there, although we have, you know, good indication that we think it should be. But this is the most conservative comparison you can make, and if the most conservative comparison has tension, then you still really have tension. So, yes? Which are you talking about? The data points. Yes, that's right. I mean, this is G of V, so this is the monotonically decreasing quantity. Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes, this is great. Give me two transparencies. I think I'll say it again. But I agree with you. But I'll say it again in a bigger plot. Okay. So So clearly there's tension, and the question is, how much tension is there? So you can ask yourself the following question. What do I have to believe in order to believe that this result is dark matter? So what else do I have to imagine? What else do I have to imagine is going on if I want to make these results consistent with one another? So here is the latest xenon result. And as Raphael, I think, that's right, as Raphael was telling us, there are various cuts in software cuts on xenon about the amount of S1 signal and S2 signal they require in order for an event to appear on this plot. And so there's this complicated issue of how exactly you turn the observables, which are this S1 signal and this S2 signal, into quantities that theorists like myself are used to thinking about, which is the recoil energy. And there is this translation for the recoil energy into the average S1 signal. But of course, the average is just that. It's just an average. And especially for these low S1s, we're talking about just a few photoelectrons. There can be large Poisson fluctuations on top of that. So you have to worry about these Poisson fluctuations. So thanks to Peter Sorensen, I'm able to worry about such things. So he Monte Carlo'd this whole thing, and to see exactly how often, say, a 3 keV recoil would fluctuate above the cuts that which are 3 for S1. So there's a small fraction of the time that something that looks nominally below this threshold would actually show up above this threshold and would appear on this plot. So this is the type of thing you have to worry about. But conveniently enough for people like me, he has produced a series of results that basically allow me to never have to think about S1 and only think about E-recoil, because he's done all this Monte Carlo and Poisson fluctuations and such. And Raphael can tell me if this looks anything like what it should look like. And allows me to determine an efficiency as a function of the recoil energy, which is then something I would have to convolve with my prediction from CDMS to see what the prediction of xenon would be. So that's something I can do. And we can ask how wrong. So nominally, we'll see for this efficiency, there's considerable amount of tension. So how wrong does this efficiency have to be? What has to be going wrong in order for these two results to be consistent? At zero where? Oh, most of the events have zero S1. Yeah. And in fact, I think I've binned this on half S1, so it's between zero and a half. Yeah, I don't have a good. I don't know if I can explain the physics of this. Okay, so this is Aaron's question. If here are the three events. At CDMS silicon with their energies, and then when I undo the efficiency of the detector and the form factor, this is what the underlying distribution, the actual recoil rate as a theorist thinks about it would have looked like this. So here again are the three events, and your point, Aaron, is just that this third one you would expect to be a lot lower, or alternatively, another way of saying it is you might have expected there to be more events down at lower energy. But rather conveniently, at least for the approach I'm advocating. That's fine. Yes, go ahead, answer that question. Oh, you mean this one? Oh, just this one. This is just the three events with their energies at CDMS. Oh, so the error bars are just, as you see down here, I'm imagining that maybe they saw three events and that was an upward fluctuation from whatever three events upward fluctuate, 1.7. For instance. So these are just the 90% Poisson error bars, if you like. So. No, you can't. If the expected is zero, you'll never get anything, right? So let me forget about the binning. Let me just do it just for all three of them, because it's easier. So if I have three events and 90%, then that could be, with 90% confidence, three events could be an upward fluctuation from 1.7. Yeah. That's these three events. These three events. OK? With me?
Yeah.
No, the plots, the plots, I'm terrible at making plots. So I could have made the. But all that matters is the numbers. So the point is that rather conveniently, so this is not what you would expect, Aaron, as you said, but rather conveniently, this does seem to be consistent with a relatively flat distribution. So then I can just take this as my observed G of V from, this is a very, very conservative G of V, if you like. So naively, every time you see an uptick, you'd expect that to correspond to another step up in this monotonic function. So if this rate had been far higher, then I would expect my G of V to look like a staircase going upwards into the infrared. But rather conveniently, it's pretty reasonable to just assume it's a completely flat distribution like this. And then that allows me to do this translation from one experiment to another in a very straightforward way. So for the purpose of this comparison between CDMS and xenon, as we saw, that they seem to be somewhat in tension with one another. So I'm going to try every little trick I have to try and put them back into no time. Stop talking. Okay. Well, somebody should ask me a question about how I on earth can make these two results consistent with one another, and I will tell you. So you could imagine. So there's three events here, and maybe this outlier here is a background event because I did, after all, expect 0.7 of an event of background. And you can ask how to make them consistent with one another, and you'll see that you have a great deal of trouble. Even if you imagine that one of the events was background and not signal, this is the number of events you would expect as a function of dark matter mass at xenon, assuming that the efficiency in xenon remained what it is down to this value. But if it goes to zero at this recoil energy, then of course you don't get to see any events below that threshold. So that's one way you could imagine trying to make the results consistent with one another. Xenon apparently, even though the efficiency curves look like they have good sensitivity here, you could imagine that they don't. That's one way you could try to make these results consistent. And even that doesn't help you very much. And I guess I'll stop there. I have a few more slides to go, but I'll just instead take questions. Yes? Yes, so that is the sort of average efficiency, that's right. Yes, there is. I don't know what that error bar is, but Peter only presents the average.
Other questions? So we should probably talk offline because I guess I'm a little confused here. So one thing we found in a recent paper led by Yao is that sort of what you, whether or not this, the different papers, the Franzen paper and then the Del Noble paper, I think they seem to be assuming different values for the xenon threshold and different prescriptions for the efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big mess down here, whether the V-min technique actually is applicable depends upon that prescription. So what we actually did was we sort of simply took what the thresholds were given to us by xenon and CDMS. And in that case, there's certainly still wiggle room with the astrophysical distribution. And maybe I said that. I didn't make it clearly enough in my talk.
No, I know. I remember you said it in your talk.
Okay. I guess that's a point to be made for this highly depends upon the prescriptions still for the thresholds and the efficiencies for xenon.
Right, that's right. So I mean, that's why we went to talk to Peter, who has these nice efficiency curves, which are supposed to be fairly representative of what the actual efficiencies are. So they're supposed to look something like this. These are, I should have said, the blue and the red are for two different measurements of L effective. And I think for the plot I just showed you, I took the most conservative efficiency. But then the game we're playing is, imagine that this is wrong, and just that below some recoil, the efficiency just goes straight to zero.
Yeah, so I like the question that you're asking, and that is, what would you have to believe to go wrong in xenon to believe, right? I mean, aside from what you showed, that you can do other halos and you're good. We should look at that. I think you're turning the wrong knob.
Okay, that could be fine, yeah.
The L effective below 3 kV has no impact whatsoever.
No. So I may have labeled badly here. What I meant was...
Is that just the L effective, or is that all your efficiency?
No, all the efficiency. No, the efficiency. But I was imagining the way in which it would happen is that L effective goes to zero and you get no S1 signal. But that would just be one way you could do it. But really what I'm imagining is that this curve is good, blah, 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 and then just goes to zero. And the point at which it goes to zero is the y-axis.
Ah, okay, yeah, yeah. No, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I guess then what you're seconding is what Chris said the other day. That is that yes, our limits seem to be rather conservative, I guess.
Your limits are conservative, and they're already causing a lot of trouble to CDMS. So there's.
So you know when you do your translation,
right.
Come here.
Oh, sorry, right. Thanks.
Do you know when you do your translation between energies between two different experiments?
Yes.
So you have E1, E2, but those actually, so in your format, presumably those are the true recall energies.
Yes, that's correct.
In reality, of course,
yes.
E1, E2 are estimators.
That's
there,
right.
There are uncertainties, energy resolution, Poisson fluctuations.
That's
do
right.
you, can you account for that as well?
So what we try to do is be as conservative. So they give binned results typically, and what you try to do is be as conservative as possible in going from A to B. So what you do is pick wherever in that bin, or average over the bin, whatever it is that would predict the smallest rate at the lowest energy in the second experiment, to try to be as. So this is clearly, you know, falling into the complaint that we're being too conservative. But if there's tension when you're too conservative, then.
So I just want to clarify. I mean, most of the tension is coming from assuming that xenon should have seen events at very low threshold, and they didn't.
So there's two
Even
things.
Even though the analysis was cut at 6.6.
No.
That's the part that I'm getting confused with.
No. So. Yeah. So you don't. This is all your event. That's correct.
So is it enough to just look at the events above that? What is there to include that line?
I guess that's the part I'm confused about.
So the point is that you have to worry. So this is the point. There's an S1 cut, which is not. You shouldn't look at this x-axis here. At least the way I think about it, you should look at this x-axis, or the top x-axis. And the point is that they really cut on S1, which is 3. And the point is that for a 3 kV recoil, which nominally is below this blue dashed line, actually sometimes it gives you an S1 of 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever. Passes all your efficiency cuts. Shows up in this analysis. They see two events following their procedure, and as you saw from this contour plot, we're talking about tens of events or more in some places, and that's above the blue line. And additionally, there should be more events below the blue line, which I think you would have put on that plot.
So there's all the dashed lines that you see in the plot that have not been cut, so you have those events would be there.
Right.
The reason where
which plot, sorry? Yeah, I was forced to. This plot here you're talking about, or the plot? Oh, sure. So this is the dark matter mass. That's all I'm saying. And then as Raphael was saying, this is perhaps a bad label, but this energy here in kV is the point at which I imagine the efficiency deviates from what I've been told and goes exactly to zero. So in other words, I multiply this efficiency by a step function that turns to zero at this energy. Okay. So that means I'm insensitive below that energy to anything. The lines are the number of events you'd expect to see at xenon. So here you'd expect to see 50 events for a dark matter mass of 12 GeV. Given the uppermost event at CDMS was background. Now, if you imagine they're all signal, which is this one here, then you're really in trouble. So I'm throwing the kitchen sink at this, right? I'm just imagining that. Since they expected to see 0.7, one of them was background. It's best case scenario is it's the highest energy event, so let me throw the highest energy event away. Then let me also imagine that their efficiencies at xenon are nowhere near as good as they think they are, and still they're in trouble. For an elastically scattered.
There's a question back.
Sorry.
Yes.
Great. So this method can integrate out the astrophysics uncertainties, but not the particle physics uncertainties.
For sure. Yeah.
Let's say that
That's
if you have isospin violation thing, then you can actually the xenon boundary will not be here, right? Oh, good.
But I didn't have time.
Okay.
So yes, you can do that with isospin dependence. That's right.
Okay.
Yep. So you can get around it with isospin dependence, and then there are various things that leads to. So the Dharma rate would have to be almost 100% modulated. You wouldn't expect to see anything at cogent then. Then there's other things you can do. You can do exit anyway. I don't have time, but yeah. So you can play this game. You can then throw. So you can throw experimental kitchen sink at it. You can throw particle kitchen sink at it, and you can throw other kitchen sinks, and you can see which works. Hmm? Yeah. I'll buy you a beer later.
Okay. So in honor of Roberto, one of the conference organizers, I'm going to think in a Bayesian context here.
Okay.
So you know, you do this for a given Wnt mass. You know, you check the consistency, and then you know, at some point we see results are consistent, and now we're starting to say we've detected something potentially.
Yeah, awesome.
At what point do you say, do you think it's appropriate to say, sort of forego this analysis, then sort of jump into multi-dimensional statistical analysis, determine what the Wnt mass is, you know, putting in all the appropriate parameters from particle physics and astrophysics? I mean, can you actually, I guess the question is, how well can you actually determine a Wnt mass from this procedure?
So you could, yeah, I think you can do exactly that, right? You can just, now you can do a full likelihood fit to all the parameters and all the data. And the point is
using this method?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, it's not clear. But
so I mean, the point is, if it's binned, then one of the nice things of the experiments themselves are basically measuring a staircase G of V, and you can ask, when do those staircase G of Vs with their error bars start to overlap with one another as you float all the particle physics parameters, the mass, the cross section, all those things. Yeah.
So you say that the astrophysics doesn't matter that much, but you're still making this conservative assumption, right, about a delta function.
Sure.
So, I mean, why not say astrophysics matters, and then let's suppose that Maria Angela and Annie are correct, and you can get some, let's suppose then that dark matter doesn't self-interact, and then the stars in these local area essentially give some idea of the local velocity distribution of dark matter, then you can relax those and you can do much better, right, with this?
Sure, you can, if you take that as an input, you'll do a lot better, that's right. Or you could turn it around and you could say this is another measurement of the same thing, and you could ask whether those are consistent.
Yeah, so that's the other point, was that in the future, whenever we know what the Wnt mass is, like next year or two, and we have thousands of detected scatterings, then you can get back to the science that really matters,
right,
and try to constrain. you can say, does the local velocity distribution of dark matter, does it match what you would expect just from a halo distribution, indicating that it's all been washed out by all these streams have been washed out by self-interacting dark matter or not?
That's right.
I obviously don't have enough beers with my collaborator.
Yes.
I just have a very stupid question. So let's say you take your method, do the analysis, and then you can take the kind of older method, just assume some distribution, do the analysis, you make the plot on MX and a cross-section plot. Can you find a case that the conclusions will be completely different if you use these two different methods?
Sure, yeah. So I didn't get a chance to make that plot, because as you've learned, I'm very bad at making plots. But you can basically ask, if you wanted, you could overlay what the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution predicts on top of these things and see how they differ. And the reason why they would differ is, of course, xenon needs a higher, for a light WIMP, xenon needs a higher speed WIMP coming in, and if there's, so they get an extra boost from that in the rate from that high speed tail. Now, if we have no observational evidence for that high speed tail from CDMS, then you would expect, then things get even worse. The tension gets even larger, because the xenon rate would be even bigger. So this is a very conservative way of comparing different experiments and seeing, because you basically don't assume there are any, you don't assume there's any support in the speed distribution at places where you haven't already measured it, or at least banded it. Yeah. You don't have to actually have measured it. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I haven't done it yet for exothermic, but it may be possible. Well, even there, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think, yes, right. This is the most conservative you can do. That's right. Because you're always limiting the speed distribution to just that part of it you've measured. And so that's certainly the lowest rate you could imagine going from one to the other. And then Maxwell-Boltzmann may or may not agree with that. But it would, the only way in which you couldn't agree is to have support elsewhere.
Okay, and let's thank Patty again. And we will, I guess, reconvene at 11. Okay.